This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is going to be a little bit long, so I'm going to try to be quick up front here. This week we are doing something that's rather time sensitive, particularly we talked last week about giving you a little bit of magic news from time to time, and some news that is very relevant and very time sensitive is that tonight, this is October the 14th when this episode is coming out of 2021, Sarah Krassen will be producing a show called Flavors of Magic in Manhattan. There'll be two shows, 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock p.m., and more information is available and tickets are available at flavorsofmagic.com, and that's F-L-A-V-O-R-S, not O-U-R-S, as they might spell it in the UK. Anyhow, Flavors of Magic. Check that out if you're in the area. It's something that I think that you would enjoy, going back and seeing some live entertainment. And if you would like to see some of the video virtual shows they've done, which they've done several of those in the past, they're available over on YouTube. And one of them is available on the MagicWordPodcast.com blog, so you can go there and watch that then as well. But hopefully you can help support live magic by getting out and seeing that there this evening. Well, Sarah Krassen is the Society of American Magicians' newest appointment called a Resourceress, and that's an interesting title, and she talks about that at length in this week's episode, as well as talking then about the flavors of magic and what she is doing with that. It's a way of spotlighting magicians of diversity around the world through the virtual shows she's done, she's produced, as well as now doing some things within the U.S. who are diverse backgrounds. And so anyhow, it talks a little bit about that. And also she has a book called Own Your Magic. And as an attorney, she has a great perspective and a lot of advice on how you should go about protecting your name, your brand, trademarking your show, your effects, patents, and things like that. A lot of things go into detail in the book, but there are some basic things that you can do and should do then right now that are recommended for you to go to certain websites in order to try to get this protection that you need, so that way you have your intellectual property protected. Anyhow, all that's explained here this week. I'll also mention, as we were recording this, we were doing this over Skype, so it was done as a video. And if you want to view that, you can go over to youtube.com/Texas Magician, or just do a search on YouTube for Scott Wells, and you should be able to find this week's episode, or just go to the blog at themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you can click on that and watch this week's episode and see the two of us interacting with each other. There are a few visual things that she does show us that we talk about on this podcast, but I believe you get the general idea, even if you're listening to it only through the audio. Then anyhow, I'm going to shut up, going to introduce her right now. She has a lot to say, and it's great, and I appreciate you coming back and listening here this week, and I know that you're going to enjoy my discussion this week with Sarah Krassen here on The Magic Word. Today we have another outstanding guest, someone I've been looking forward to talking with on the podcast for quite some time. She is someone who many of you know if you have attended many of the Society of American Magicians National Conventions or other reasons that you should know this person. She's been attending a lot of other conventions then as well. Perhaps one thing that might be best known to us is that she is the author of Own Your Magic, A Magician's Guide to Protecting Your Intellectual Property, and that is something that is absolutely imperative that every magician should be reading, so we know the importance of what it is that we are putting out there and making sure that it is going to be protected. We're going to talk a little bit about that, but also one of the things I really want to kind of explore here with her is the fact that she is a resourceress for the SAM, which has a new title, a new position, and so now she's going to tell us all about it. So please welcome my guest this week, the lovely Miss Sarah Krassen. Hey, Sarah.
Hi, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm so glad
to be here.
I am so glad that we finally got together then as well, because it seems we've gotten together and talked and had a few martinis, when we're at the magic conventions, and we've talked about trying to actually get some time together. And so now, even though we're doing this via Skype, we are finally getting together to put this out. That's great. So you're looking good, and you've been keeping busy, I'm sure.
Oh my goodness, yes. I've been very busy and with wonderful projects. I apparently don't like to be bored.
Yep.
And don't like to sleep so much. So I create projects to keep myself busy. And you mentioned that the title of Resourceress of the Society of American Magicians.
Yes.
They very kindly made this special position for me. And the goal of the position is to allow me to be a resource to members of the SAM and to help them put together different programs, introduce people to other people, make connections, make introductions, and to do cool stuff and help other people do the cool stuff they want to do. So I facilitate other people's projects and I come up with some ideas of my own.
Well, I was wanting to explore that because I like the title, certainly, a sorceress, since a male, I guess, would be a sorcerer and a female is a sorceress. And the fact that it has to do with the resources that you would have at your fingertips or that you can have access to, you know where to go to get these resources. So that makes you the resourceress. You're the first resourceress, I assume, of the SAM or anyone I've ever heard of anywhere.
Well, I'm the first of the SAM.
Okay.
The title, I will confess to you, Scott, that I have stolen the title.
Okay.
We steal from those we love. From the best. And so the idea came from Hal Hale, who was the librarian at the Magic Castle when I moved out to Los Angeles mm-hmm. a long time ago. I'm now back in New York, but for a while after college, I lived in L.A., and he was the librarian and was a wonderful friend and mentor and took me under his wing and introduced me to people and was just so kind. And it has a special place in my heart. And Hal had a plaque on his desk that titled him Resourcerer.
Yes.
And I loved it. So it's a title that I wanted because it's appropriate to what I'm doing.
Right.
It has that magical flair. And it gives me a special warm, fuzzy feeling because I think about Hal.
Well, as far as the resources go, what do you tap into? Are they books and videos or are they people you put in touch with people to say we can help improve your act? I mean, like when Joni Spina was around, you would have called her and said, Joni, I think this person could use your help. Or do you put people together or what exactly does a resourceress do?
Whatever she wants. It's my kind of position.
It's mine. Whatever I want to do, I'm the resourceress.
Yes, exactly.
The Almighty.
I wouldn't go quite that far. I like to say resourcery means never having to ask permission. What do? I connect people who have chocolate to people who have peanut butter.
That's a good way of putting it. Okay.
So I talk to a lot of people about what kinds of programs they're doing, what they're looking to do, what they're interested in. And then I connect people who want to do something with other people who might be interested in doing something similar. So, for example, there were a lot of assemblies who wanted to do virtual lectures for their meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And there was wonderful opportunity because everybody was going virtual. And this was a new opportunity to have lecturers for an assembly that normally weren't on a route that the people they wanted to hear would take. So I could connect people who wanted to lecture with people who wanted a speaker.
Okay.
Chocolate and the peanut butter together. So people who wanted to lecture got the experience and got to sell their notes and their stuff.
You know, right.
The assemblies who wanted a lecturer, wanted a program, got a fantastic program that they might not otherwise have access to. And I get to help make that happen.
So when you're putting things together, do they come to you? Do they go to the SAM National? Is there a website? How do they get in contact with you if they want something or need something or have something they want to offer?
Sometimes they reach out to me directly. Sometimes uh-huh. they reach out to the SAM in general. So, for example, the SAM has a form on its website to ask the SAM a question.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes, you know, the administrator gets those inquiries, and then Mano, who's the national administrator, will sometimes not know quite what to do with one of those inquiries. It doesn't seem to fit into the, any of the usual categories. So she'll send it to me. And I'm in conversations with, there's a composer here in New York who wrote a musical based on the life of Harry Houdini.
Mm-hmm.
And it's he's trying to get it produced here in New York, and he wanted to do a like a flash mob of magicians to promote his project.
Oh, uh-huh. So
he reached out to the SAM, and so I the inquiry got directed to me, and I've had a few conversations with him about what that might look like and what he would want and how to get people to participate. I reached out to the SAM membership and said, hey, who's in New York and might want to do something like this? Maybe there'll be a component that's remote that could be performing in other places, since it's eventually going to be digital. There could be clips of magicians in other cities. Who wants to do this? And so I have a list of magicians who are interested in performing, and the composer who's working on this musical and has some resources to put on the event. And I'm trying to help them all come together. And so when the composer is ready to actually do it, then we'll see what happens and, you know, what we decide to do with the project, what it's eventually going to look like.
So kind of a producer in a way, in which you are producing, you're finding both sides and then putting this project together in that case.
I suppose so. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I'm wondering about other types of things where someone might be looking for a resource, specifically a book, or is there something you know of that has ever been published in someone's lecture notes or something? Do they come to you and say, have you ever seen this trick before? I've had people come and ask me that, saying, is this new or is this published someplace? When you've been around for a while and you've got a vast library and some knowledge, people will come and ask you. So I'm assuming they do that too.
I get a little bit of that. I get more inquiries about magicians who want to deaccession material from their collections or their libraries and kind of want some help in figuring out what to do with it. So I try to connect them to somebody, a book dealer or somebody who's in that trade. You know, it's I don't value stuff. I don't buy and sell. I just connect people who want things done to the people who do them.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And there was a project here for the last several months that you've been working with. We were just talking about before we came on. What's that called, about the Flavors of Magic?
Flavors of Magic is I'm so excited that this came together. The social justice movement really sparked a lot of thought in me, and I've been thinking about how the magic community can do better. And I was writing about this and talking to people about it, and a magician said to me, well, we should do a show to highlight BIPOC, you know, Black, Indigenous, and people of color in magic.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, that's a great idea. Yeah, we should. And so we are.
Right.
So we put together, and thus was Flavors of Magic born.
Ah, well, I see. I get the idea now.
So it's a project to highlight the diversity of the magic community. And we take a really broad view of diversity. It includes BIPOC performers, magicians with disabilities, women, you know, LGBTQ performers. And so we put together a virtual series, what we're calling season one of Flavors of Color was a virtual series, 7 episodes, about an hour apiece.
Wow.
With performers, mostly from the U.S., but some from abroad, performing from their home studios and showing the diversity, not just of the performers, but of the artistic choices that they make. Because our thinking is that when you have that the artistic choices that a performer makes are often based, at least in part, in who they are and where they come from. And so we had this, you know, fantastic group of performers coming from different places, different backgrounds, different histories, and different perspectives, And so the performances were very varied. And I'm enormously proud of what's out there. The first 7 episodes are all still available online. And we are moving on now that we're doing things in person again and things are starting to open up. We are we have a date for our first Flavors of Magic live show, October 14th, Thursday night in Manhattan in the Theater District at the Russian Samovar. And we're doing a 7 o'clock show and a 9 o'clock show. Eric Walton is a fantastic mentalist. RJ, the magician, is does fast-paced comedy magic. I'm going to host and do a set along with my performing partner, Bamberg. And I'm so excited. It's going to be such a great show. And it's a kind of proof of concept and a first entry. I'm hoping that it works out and it inspires us to continue and make this an ongoing effort.
Is it something in which you're thinking about maybe taking on the road or encouraging other cities to pick up the gauntlet as well and say, yes, we're going to try this in our city or in Chicago or in New York or Denver, wherever it's going to be? I mean, L.A., is it something that or would it be a traveling show in which you'd take this group and kind of go around?
My thinking right now is that it wouldn't so much be a touring show as something that could be built in other places. Doing the virtual show helped me build a lot of contacts in around the country, really. So if somebody asked me, okay, you know, let's, you know, do a show in Chicago, in LA, and, you know, I don't know, name the city. I could maybe pull together a show in that city.
Okay.
And I have the phone numbers.
Gotcha. And so doing the virtual shows, again, it can be done internationally then, and I'm sure that expands the opportunities for people in other lands. And I think it's interesting also to include their cultures, how their magic and their faith, their religion, their environment, their everything is built into that. So I think it'd be...
Right. Well, the choices that somebody makes as an artist come from a variety of places. I mean, somebody picks a character to perform as, and that character often comes from a place of their own experience. Not always, but frequently. So, somebody who celebrates their heritage and their performance, or who has challenges and so can't do things right out of the box or the way that they're written, their show is going to look a little different than the average show. Is there an average magic show? I don't know. But it's going to look a little different because of whatever their background is.
Now, you were saying you were going to be actually the host of the show coming up in October. What about the virtual shows? Has there been a different host each performance, or were you the one, since you produced the thing and put it together, did you host that?
I hosted most of them. We did have a few guest hosts.
Okay.
Eric Walton hosted one. Jonathan Molo hosted one from LA.
And when you say they're still available, are they on YouTube or on Facebook, or where can people go to find them?
They're on YouTube. They're on YouTube,
yes. And so what's the website?
If you look for Flavors of Magic, you'll find it. Right now, we're having some website issues, and we're going to get that straightened out. But right now, flavorsofmagic.com leads you to the website where we have the blurbs about the live show, and we're selling tickets to the show in New York.
Right.
So absolutely use that if you want to come to the show on October 14th. And I can't remember if that also has a link to the YouTube page where all of the live shows are. But if you search for Flavors of Magic on YouTube right now, you'll find it. And in the grand future, if you're all watching this from your flying cars, flavorsofmagic.com will have a website that will have a link to the videos all on YouTube.
And for those who might be interested in wanting to participate in this and feel they are people of that would fit in this category, how do they contact you, or who do they get hold of?
You can send me an email. I'm info@flavorsofmagic.com.
Okay.
And while we are looking to highlight diverse magicians in a broad interpretation of diversity, you know, if you make interesting artistic choices, if, you know, if you want to participate, let us know and we'll talk and see if there's a way that, you know, you'll fit into what we're doing.
That's great.
We are not excluding white straight men.
I would also remind people who are watching or listening that Flavors is spelled the American way without a U. I know in English
yes.
It's F-L-A-V-O-U-R-S. So there's no U in that, in the Flavors of Magic. To find the website there as well. Now, in addition to that, I mentioned to begin with, of course, you have had this book out for some time. And has that been a passion of yours, at Own Your Magic? And it is important that people do recognize that you should own your magic, because if you don't have that, I guess, copyrighted, or you have someone else can get it, basically.
Well, yeah. I have to give you the lawyer's answer, which is no, it's totally okay. I have to give you the lawyer's answer, which is yes and no.
Yeah.
And I will do my best to talk about it like a person and not like a lawyer. That's okay. And there's a reason that everybody hates lawyers, and I understand. I really do. So, Own Your Magic and the lectures that I've been giving on the topic are all about helping magicians understand how you can protect your business. So if you make money from magic, then there are things that you should probably be thinking about. Not saying that you have to do anything, but you should at least be aware of mm-hmm. that can help you protect your business against somebody else improperly competing with you.
Okay.
So for example, I mean, you talk about copyright, and that's kind of a big one that we all know about.
Mm-hmm.
You can copyright you make a video of yourself, and you have a copyright on that, and you can stop somebody from, you know, if somebody posts it on YouTube or uses it in a way that you don't want on Instagram or something, you can make the website take it down
mm-hmm.
because you have a copyright over that video.
Okay, because you own it. Mm-hmm. Because you own it.
Right, exactly. One thing, and the book and my talk are all about understanding what you can protect and what you can't protect. And the simple, cheap, easy to do things that can give you the most protection and the most leverage if a problem develops.
Okay.
So, for example, you can't copyright an idea. So, you know, sewing through a woman. If you come up with the idea for sewing through a woman and you create it and you perform it, doesn't mean you can stop somebody else from performing that same, a magic trick with that same plot. Golden Dot, who he claimed invented
the sewing.
Sewing through a woman.
Right.
Although, we can argue about what P.C. Selbit was doing at the time and whether
Golden
should have been able
book.
To get a patent.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. There's a book, he'll have the full opinion and explanation. But Horace Golden got a patent for his box for sewing through a woman. And he licensed it. He let other people perform it. And he could stop other people from using his box without his permission because he had this patent.
Okay.
What he couldn't do is stop somebody else from making a different version of sewing. So if they could come up with another mechanism for how it would work, he couldn't stop them from creating that same effect.
So
just using his device.
So the effect, it's kind of like, I guess, Kleenex is a tissue and other people can sell tissues, just not calling it Kleenex, and it's essentially still a
right.
tissue, right?
Yes. So Kleenex would say it's not a Kleenex, it's a Kleenex brand tissue.
Okay.
So the you know, it's not a Band-Aid. It's a Band-Aid brand bandage.
Bandage. Mm-hmm.
Because they don't want Band-Aid or Kleenex is the trademark. And that's a different kind of intellectual property protection, and one that I think is really important for magic, because that's your mark, that's your designation that says, mm-hmm. this is my product, this is my show. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a tissue, it's a Kleenex tissue, and so you're getting Kleenex quality.
But there are those who would be cloning other people's acts, as you've seen forever. I mean, it depends upon whoever is the flavor of the day, whether it's going to be, it used to be Mark Wilson or Doug Henning or David Copperfield or Chris Angel or Matt King or Lance Burton, whoever it happens to be at that time. Someone sees them and says, I'm going to do that act, or I'm going to do one like that, which ends up being that act. Essentially, they kind of clone that. And there can mm-hmm. only really be one originator, but can that person then go back and say, hey, you're using my lines, you're doing my act?
Maybe some of it.
Okay.
You know, then I mean, it gets really deep into the weeds. But the most important thing that you can know about trademarks is that your name can be your trademark. Mm-hmm. If your name, whatever your stage name is, if that's your website, if your show has a particular name, that is your brand. You might have that name on social media. You might have a website with that name.
So you need to protect it.
And so think for a moment, yeah, how would it mess up your business if somebody else came to town and started doing business under that name?
There was, I talked a while back with Rob Lake, who is an illusionist, and you remember I believe it was the Netflix show of Tiger King that was just mm-hmm. crazy thing. Well, part of that in Tiger King was talking about him doing a magic act. Well, long story short, he had actually used Rob Lake's name, brand, and image in his advertising, but using these large animals. And Rob had to get his name back, and that was a very difficult and hard road for him.
Yeah. So this happened. This is actually the events that led me to write the book and to lecture about this was this exact same thing happening to a couple of magicians. And I met Roy Coopers, who's a magician and a machinist, and he makes coin gimmicks. Mm-hmm. And he was having a problem with Amazon because he sells his gimmicks to magic shops and to middlemen who then sell to magic shops and other places. And among the various places, they sell them on Amazon. Fine. So he starts one day getting calls from these middlemen saying, hey, why are you messing with my sales on Amazon? Hmm. And Roy says, what are you talking about? I'm not doing anything. And so he looks into it, and it turns out that the sales are being removed from Amazon by the company, by Amazon itself. Some guy, whose name I know but will not state, mm-hmm. Went to the United States Patent and Trademark Office and registered a trademark on the name Roy Coopers, used for magic props.
Wow.
And then he had the ability to also make coin gimmicks. Mm-hmm. I'm told they were not as good as Roy Cooper's coin gimmicks. I haven't seen them in person, but I'm willing to believe that. And he then went to Amazon, started selling his coin gimmicks as Roy Cooper's coin gimmicks, mm-hmm. went to Amazon and said, hi, Amazon, I'm Roy Cooper's magic coins. Here's my documentation for my trademark, showing you that I own the name Roy Coopers. Those sales, pointing to the authentic sales of actual Roy Coopers products, those sales are unauthorized to use my trademark.
Wow.
Take them down.
Wow.
Amazon, not wanting to mess with the actual trademark holder, mm-hmm. absolutely took those sales down. Roy, then not only losing sales, but also fielding phone calls from unhappy customers who've purchased what they thought were his product and are now angry that they don't have good coin gimmicks, mm-hmm. He then had to hire an attorney and spend approximately a year fighting in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to get his trademark back. So wow. Now he has it registered and he has it protected. But this guy, and Roy is not the only person in Magic that this particular copyright squatter, let's call it, has done this to. And
same person and has done this to other people.
To other people, and not just in the Magic world. He's apparently done this to several people in other fields that make small metal objects. He finds somebody that that makes things that he can make, and has not trademarked their name, and then he snaps up the trade, registers the trademark, and starts making the things. And then when he gets when they figure it out and come after him, he doesn't fight.
Well, do the people who have the original idea who have not trademarked their own brand, their name, do that because they just don't think about it, or they believe, hey, people will know that it's me, it's not somebody else, or is it a matter of cost? I mean, is it cost a lot in order to get that trademark, and what do you think of the reasons?
My guess is that they just don't think about it, really. Especially in the area of manufacturing props for magicians, maybe we're used to thinking of the magic community as a small community. So if a magic shop is buying props, so they know where they're getting it from, and mm-hmm. so you're not really worried about somebody from outside the community coming in and engaging in that sort of behavior. I don't know. I'm that's purely speculative, and I really don't know. But I think people just didn't really think about it, because registering a trademark is pretty easy to do. It's fairly cheap. It happens fairly quickly, and it's not terribly hard. So it's a small investment of time and energy, and can save you a lot of headache.
Could that all be done online, or do you have to go through a lawyer to do it, or
you can do it yourself online?
Okay,
absolutely, 100%. They encourage it, in fact, and it's on the USPTO's website. You can run some searches and figure out if somebody else is using a name like yours. What are they using it for? The website is, I'm going to say, excruciatingly detailed.
Okay,
but it has all the forms that you need to fill out. But I tried to make the process really straightforward and simple in here. And I actually, in my book, I not only explain to you how to do a patent search and what you need to look for to make sure that the trademark that you want is available, I take you screen by screen through the web form that they use and explain what needs to be filled out and why they're asking for things and what to help you understand what to fill out.
But let's say, for an example, going back to coins, you have a coin gimmick that is milled on the edge like a normal coin would be, and you then trademark that, and then someone else comes up and has one that is flat, has no milling on the edges. Would that be different? I mean, it's kind of like painting a blue box red, I mean, almost. I mean, is that significant enough, or at what point does the product that some ripoff guy is trying to sell vary, or even your own, if you think, hey, somebody's got an original idea, I'm going to improve on that by doing this, this, and this, and then at what mm-hmm. point, I mean, how far from the original does it have to be? Like with the box you talk about with Golden, for an example, let's say mm-hmm. if they had a sawing with two people, that's one thing, but someone comes up with an idea saying, well, we could do this with one person. Well, okay, that's different, you know. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of what you're talking about, or what is the differential?
Right. So that you're asking the one of the questions at the heart of intellectual property law, which is how different does something have to be before it's no longer infringing?
Well, you could have saved me 5 minutes, sir.
And that's what
exactly is what I was trying to say.
But I get it. I get where you're going exactly, and that's the crux of it, and that's the question that everybody wants to ask.
Sure.
If I take the product that if I take the widgets that my competitor is making, my competitor makes widgets and they're selling like hotcakes. There's a great big widget market. How different do my widgets have to be before they're infringing?
Yes.
And, you know, if I paint them, if they're red and I paint mine blue, is that enough? Do I have to, you know, just make them bigger or change something in them? And that is the question that every client wants to know. And? The answer is, you know, maybe. It's, you know,
okay.
Because here's the thing. This is something about how the law works. The law is not in the business of providing all of the rules with precise detail. Some of the rules say, well, you can't, you know, it's infringing if you make the thing. But then you have an argument about, well, does the product that I'm making qualify as the thing in the patent? So I had, I worked for a judge. We had a patent case. And the patent described a device, a board with hinges on it, and you put a shirt on the board, mm-hmm. and then you folded the different panels of this board,
right?
And it folded the shirt,
right?
And then you took out this package, and it was the shirt. Okay. Right. So then a competitor started making a version of this, and there was a patent suit. One of the items that they were fighting about was. The patent said it was a rectangular board. Mm-hmm. And the competitor was arguing, well, our corners are rounded.
Wow.
So they're different.
Okay.
The patent said it's a flat board. The competitor said, well, our board has little bubbles, little feet on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's not flat.
Okay.
And? So, you know, they're having a big fight. Oh, I'm not going to tell you the answer.
Oh, you're killing me. I want to hear the rest of the story. Come on, Paul Harvey, tell me.
But they're having a big and a legitimate battle in federal court, mm-hmm. about what does it mean to be rectangular? And this is the kind of fight you have in a patent case. You know, these tiny little differences. Because a patent is a really powerful thing. It gives you an exclusive right to make or use the device for 20 years.
Okay.
Which is, I mean, that's a big power. But it's got to be in exchange, and it's a deal you make with the government. So the government gives you these exclusive rights, and in exchange, you give the government, the public at large, a complete explanation of how this thing works, mm-hmm. and kind of how to make it. So you provide all the drawings and written explanations of how it works and how all what all the pieces do and so forth. And they have to be precise descriptions. And your patent only gives you this exclusivity over what you've described.
Okay.
So that was why they're having this argument and saying, well, you described a rectangular flat device, and we have a round-edged three-dimensional device. And so they're different. And the question is it different enough? And every case is gonna turn on these kinds of distinctions.
Well, I've heard before one of the stories where the person who invented the bobby pin back whenever the turn of the 1900s made a lot of money on bobby pins. The ladies were putting their hair, obviously, but the person who made more money was the one who dipped them in wax. So this way, because women were always, you know, opening them with their teeth as they were, you know, put them in their mouth and whatever, and they were chipping their teeth because it was just a wire. So this guy put some wax or something, I believe, on them. So this way they wouldn't chip their teeth. Then he sold more than what the originator was. And apparently that was enough of a difference that he made more money than the originator of the bobby pin.
Well, that's a great example of competition in action.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the creator of the bobby pin had a patent or what the situation was there, but you know, it's the idea of making a product and then somebody else saying, hey, that's a great product. I'm going to make another version. I have an idea for how to improve that product. and I'm going to make mine, and I'm going to make it better by doing this.
Right.
And that's competition. And mm-hmm. it keeps us innovating and inventing and improving, hopefully.
Well, when you're also talking yeah. about having to file a patent that would have the blueprints, basically how people can make this, I've had that discussion with Walter Zaney Blaney on many occasions uh-huh. in which he was saying, I don't want to ever put my ladder levitation out there because then people can have the ability to make it. Even though I'm not authorizing right. that, I would have proven, I guess, through owning that patent that I am the inventor of that. But the world pretty much knows I've already invented it, but I don't want everyone to know how it works because you're essentially giving up a secret of something, and the general public, right. who might be more than just idly curious, who can go and look it up, can find out how that's mm-hmm. done or how a sawing is done or many of these illusions, perhaps, if magicians would go out and actually have them patented, number one. Number two is the cost that's involved with that. But then it comes to perhaps an even larger cost if you have someone who later does patent and you're having to come back and say, no, that was my idea. Well, you can't. It's harder to try to prove that. You had the original providence of that at a certain point before this person came in, and et cetera, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But my point is, you would have a lot of financial expense as well as emotional angst and everything, I think, tied to this to get your own product back. But I understand why magicians in general would not want to have their product or their idea or invention actually patented because everyone would see how it's done.
Hang on one second. You raised a lot of really good points there, and I want to make sure that I cover them. So I write down a few notes.
Okay.
And you're absolutely right about all of it. And as was Walter, that's the bargain that you make is in exchange for getting the exclusivity, you give information about right. how it works. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of magicians, Walter was not alone in this, that magicians don't want to get patents because they don't want the world to have this information.
Right.
So lots of magicians don't patent. Sometimes magicians do patent, but they call it something confusing or opaque.
So they can't look up the name of that. In other words, instead of sawing
it. Exactly. It's a theatrical device.
Okay.
It's just something.
So it's buried someplace.
It's a little hard to find using your usual search terms.
Right. Right.
So some magicians have patented things, in that way to try to get the protection and keep the secret.
Mm-hmm.
The other and in fact patenting, because I brought up Golden and the sawing, his patent bit him in the behind a little bit.
Why?
A couple of years after he got the patent. Camel Cigarettes came out with their "It's fun to be fooled, it's more fun to know" mm-hmm. cigarette ad.
Right.
And these were like comic strip cartoons that were published in all the big newspapers of the day. And they were comic strips where magic secrets were exposed. And so they explained, this is how the trick works. It's fun to be fooled. It's more fun to know that this is how, somebody escapes from a block of ice. It's fun to be fooled, but it's more fun to know that Camel Cigarettes, have the best cancer, whatever it was. So they revealed in this series of comics, they revealed his sawing. And he was upset about that. He sued them in the Southern District of New York in federal court. And the judge said, no, sir. You revealed this information to the public. They haven't done anything they're not allowed to do. They're not making your device. They're just talking about your device. And they're allowed to do that.
Huh.
You got the patent. You got exclusivity in exchange for giving up this information. They're using the information in a way that's allowed by the patent. They can do it.
To talk about how this is made or whatever the secret might be.
Interesting.
Exactly. Okay.
They can reveal the secret. They can talk exactly about how it works.
Because it is available to the public, because once it is a matter of public record, obviously the public can discuss that however
right.
they wish. Wow.
Exactly.
So that is another really bad downside on that. Hmm.
And you also nailed one of the other challenges, which is enforcement. And once you have these rights, once you have established and maybe you've registered, gotten a patent, whatever it is, then it's up to you to enforce your rights. These aren't, it's not like these are criminal actions where the police comes and takes somebody away for copyright infringement. These are rights that, it gives you the right to sue somebody to make them stop.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be expensive. And suing somebody is generally not fun. It's disruptive to your life and your business. I have yet to meet anybody who enjoyed being deposed.
Right.
It can take, if it only took a year, that would be a fairly short litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably going to cost you a significant amount of money. So it may be worth it to you. It may not be worth it to you economically. It may have other benefits. But nobody, as far as I know, nobody ever got rich suing a magician.
Okay.
So, you have to think, what's the upside here? If I win, an award from the court, am I going to collect? So
if somebody, for an example, that Penn and Teller had that shadow.
Overshadows.
Yes. And he sued the person and won. But it was him suing someone rather than them suing him because someone took the idea. You want to just talk about that just a little bit? You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, okay. Yes. The Shadows lawsuit. Barkety in, I think, in Belgium. Yes. It's a really interesting lawsuit. And the it's a little challenging to talk about in short form just because of the intricacies of it. Basically, this guy posted some video on YouTube saying that he would sell you the secret to do this trick, and I forget what he called it, the rose, the something rose, and it was the same idea. And in fact, he performed it much as Teller does in his show. And if you are not familiar with Teller's piece Shadows, it is up on YouTube. I recommend you see it. It's gorgeous. So he performed it, and the idea is that you have a rose and a vase and a light, so that the flower casts a shadow on a screen. Teller then takes a knife and cuts the shadow. And as he cuts the petals on the shadow, the petals on the rose in the vase fall off.
Mm-hmm.
And so it continues from there with him interacting with the screen and the rose reacting. So this guy, Barkety, posts the video. You've seen Penn and Teller do shadows. Here's my, I'm going to tell you how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So there were two main claims. One was a copyright claim because Teller actually copyrighted his choreography for Shadows. It's a silent piece, but a long time ago, he wrote out the choreography and registered a copyright on it. And there was also an unfair competition kind of claim saying that because he referenced Penn and Teller in his advertisement saying that he was going to, you've seen Penn and Teller do it, now I'm going to teach you how,
mm-hmm.
that it might deceive his potential customers into thinking that this was actually their version or blessed by them somehow, was inappropriate.
But going back to what you said about Golden, where he had patented that also, and then the public, since it was in the public domain, the public can talk about it. And so if Teller had, gotten the copyright for the choreography, they could talk about the choreography of that, couldn't they? Without bringing in the branded name of Penn and Teller.
Patents and copyrights give you different protections.
Okay.
So a patent gives you protection over a device. There are some other aspects to it too, but let's leave that for now.
Yeah.
So you can patent a device, a box. So the box for sawing a woman in half is a good example. A copyright is used to protect the expression of an idea. So it's a book is going to be copyrighted. A piece of music gets copyrighted. The choreography for a dance can be copyrighted. And so that's what Teller did, is he wrote down the choreography, the pantomime.
Right.
That is Shadows, and he had a copyright on that. Now, again, it doesn't, like the patent, it doesn't stop anybody from talking about it, just like I don't have to have a copyright license for a book in order to write a review of the book.
Oh, true.
Okay. I can talk about what I liked about it, what I didn't like about it. But if I want to print a copy, or if I want to put on a production of a play, I have to get a license to the play.
Okay. So I cut you off. You were continuing on with the lawsuit.
Right. So there were two problems. There was a copyright problem because this guy, Doge, it was his name. I think Barkety was his stage name, maybe? Gerard Doge, had possibly performed it that in a way that was infringing on Teller's copyright. And also this unfair competition trademark kind of claim that he was implying that maybe Penn and Teller had approved it or this was their product, which it was not. It was Doge's own version. So they had the lawsuit, and the ins and outs of the lawsuit are really interesting if you're a lawyer, and not terribly interesting if you're not. But the important things to know is that Barkety was in, I think, Belgium, did not have U.S. counsel, and Teller, the lawsuit was in federal court in Las Vegas. Teller was very well counseled, and the likelihood of somebody who is not familiar with U.S. law, who is pro se or representing themselves in court, defeating a major law firm is small, especially on something technical like intellectual property claims. It did not help that Doge failed to show up to trial.
Okay.
That did not help his case, nor did it help his case that he apparently destroyed some of the evidence.
Wow. Okay.
So it's, you know, while it is a fascinating case, it's not the greatest case for laying out exactly where the lines are, because it was not really sort of well fleshed out in the litigation process. But the court determined that he had in fact infringed and unfairly competed, and that he therefore was enjoined, was prohibited from doing it anymore, had to take down the advertisement of the piece, and owed Teller some money.
Wow. Well, you touched on something else there, and before we kind of start to get towards that and wrapping up, that had to do then with copyright of books and things. I know there are always claims of people saying they had pirated my intellectual property. Specifically, I have put this book in the Library of Congress. I've got an ISBN number. It's copyrighted, et cetera. And then there are hundreds of pirated ripoff PDFs and whatever else of that. Is there anything that can be done, or how do you chase that down? Or
yes and no.
I expected nothing less than that.
I'm frustrating. I'm so sorry.
I understand.
Oh, I feel like such a terrible person. okay, so what it comes down to is, I said before, you know, you never get rich. Nobody ever got rich suing a magician. Litigation is hard. You know, sometimes you got to litigate, but usually, if you can avoid it, then why not avoid it? So while I talk a little bit about litigation, and I'm happy to discuss the process and so forth. But there are things that you can do shy of litigating. There's you can negotiate. There's arbitration, where you have a neutral party, you know, somebody that you both trust, maybe helping you negotiate who can do what or who has the rights to what. I talk about things that you can do that give you the best bargaining position or give you the most leverage. So getting a copyright is one thing. Registering it is another. You can build a trademark just by using it, but if you register the trademark, that gives you some extra leverage, and it makes your life a little bit easier. It puts you in a better position. So when when we think about this stuff, because we're magicians and this is not, you know, the music industry with the resources and the economies of the music industry. I tend to focus on, you know, small things that you can do that put you in a better position to prevent problems or to give you leverage if they come up. So, getting back to your question, which was, I'm sorry.
Having to do with books and trying to protect yourself because there are particularly
right,
in other countries.
The websites, the downloadable PDFs. Right. Okay. So, I would say that fighting a website based in Russia that is providing a PDF of your book is going to be a very difficult battle to win because they are in Russia and suing them is going to be really hard. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's really hard. And I would question, I'm not saying it's not possible, but I would question if somebody's going to lose enough money from those downloads to make it worth it to go after that. What you can do for fairly cheap, almost nothing. Often those websites, they don't rely on somebody going to, you know, random string of numbers dot whatever the suffix for Russia is dot and searching for the PDF. People will create a Pinterest page that has the cover graphics of books, and the graphic is a link to that Russian website.
Oh wow.
So if you're searching for the, you know, the title of a book, you'll get a hit for this Pinterest page has a picture of the cover.
Okay.
And then that takes you to the place where you can download it. Well, Pinterest is a US website and they take copyright infringement quite seriously and are subject to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA. Which creates what we in the law call a safe harbor for internet companies, YouTube, Pinterest, any place where users can post stuff, which is that if the website is not going to be responsible for what its users post, as long as the website is responsive to takedown requests. So they're not going to get sued as long as if somebody posts a picture of your book and it has a link. If you email Pinterest, and almost every big website, YouTube, you know, whatever you can think of, will have a DMCA report page on it with a form that you can fill out. And if you fill out that form and you give them, here's the direct link to the infringing graphic. This is my graphic. I have a copyright on this. They don't have the right to use it. Pinterest will take that down. So you can't, but it's very hard and expensive to get the website in Russia to stop hosting the PDF. Mm-hmm. It's not as hard to take down the links or the sources that allow people to find the website in Russia where the PDF is available.
I hate to sound too much negative on this. However, it's like playing whack-a-mole because, again, once you've done that and Pinterest or YouTube and others, because I've done this with the books published of Banachek's, and whenever we identify that or someone tells us that, hey, this is there, I'll send them information, and it takes more of my time than it does for them to push a button and repost that on someone else's Pinterest page. And so it's, again, and I talked to Max Maven and several other people, and it's kind of like they just kind of shrug and say, nothing you can really do. At some point, you just really got to give up. I mean, I've paid services to go and try and find this, but again, it's just whack-a-mole. Pops up three other places, and you knock one down.
Yeah, there is no perfect solution here. There isn't really an automated solution, and it's unfortunate. But yeah, it's whack-a-mole. That's exactly the right image.
Yeah. Well, as we start to close up over here, I want you again to talk about the name of the book and where people can get a copy of that and why they should actually buy it and read it and take advantage of this.
So yes, it's owned. You thought I wasn't going to have a copy? It's Own Your Magic, A Magician's Guide to Protecting Your Intellectual Property.
Okay.
The foreword is by David Copperfield. He very generously wrote the foreword for it. It is available on Amazon and through your favorite magic retailer, through their website. And it's a book to help you understand what intellectual property rights you have over your work, over your creation, over your business, and what you can do to help protect your business.
And even if you don't buy the book, your bottom line recommendation would be for what?
While I am a lawyer, I am not your lawyer, so I cannot give advice or make recommendations. But, I think that magicians should think more about what they own that can be protected. I think that trademarks are really underutilized by magicians. And it's a small, simple thing that you can do to help protect your business is to register a trademark over the name of your business.
Easy to do, cheap and easy. Just go to the website and do that. Even if it's only just your name, you wouldn't have to go and worry about trying to copyright a trick that you've done or whatever else. It just so this way,
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a trademark. It's a trademark over your name, and really, it gives you the best leverage. If somebody else comes to your town and sets up doing business under that name, you go to their venue, to their, you know, their web server, you know, whatever it is, and you say, hey, this is my trademark. They are infringing on my trademark. And that's going to get you a lot of traction.
There are a lot of other people out there who have the same name. In other words, I know there's a Scott Wells who owns a ballet dance academy, I think, in California. Of course,
right.
There's a Scott Wells who is a football player. There's a doctor, Scott Wells. I get emails by mistake sometimes from patients. I say, hey, you know, I don't need this personal information. I'm the wrong guy. My point is, copyright my name, there are many other people with Sarah Krasen name, for an example.
They're actually not. If you find a Sarah Krasen, it's me.
Okay. But if you Google Scott Wells, I'm assuming, I don't Google myself, but if you do, I would imagine there are several Scott Wells. And if you, Tom Jones, whatever your name is, you know.
Right. So if what we're talking about, trademark, not copyright, because that protects a different thing.
Yes, sir. Ma'am.
But the trademark, thank you. The trademark, when you register a trademark, you register it for a particular purpose. So Scott Wells, there could be a Scott Wells trademark for medical services. There could be a Scott Wells trademark for the Scott Wells t-shirt company.
Mm-hmm.
And those two things, because the services, the use of the mark doesn't overlap. It's not going to confuse any customers. The point of the real purpose of a trademark is so that customers aren't confused. So if somebody goes looking for Dr. Scott Wells and they Google Scott Wells and they come up with a magician, they're probably going to figure out it's not the Scott Wells they're looking for. So they're not, you know, they're not worried. Now, if somebody emails you by accident, you know, that happens. But if they find your website, they're not going to call you and try to make a medical appointment, right?
Right.
So trademarks, when you register a trademark, you register it for a particular category.
Makes sense. Thank you.
And they have an enormous tome at the USPTO, the Patent and Trademark Office, that lists all of the possible categories. And there are a handful of categories that generally apply to magic. But if it's for, you know, garments or, you know, whatever, you name the thing, you register a trademark for that thing.
Gotcha.
So it's not for everything everywhere. It's for use in your field.
Okay. Fine and dandy. Got it. So
that.
What?
Oh, Jesus. Sorry. You use fine and dandy.
Yeah, fine and dandy.
Yeah. Well, it's the name of a song. I don't know if you know the song. It's,
no, what?
Okay. So, there's this thing that magicians do, and I've seen it my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And or like when you're vamping for time or doing some kind of parody, and there's you may have seen this, that something like da 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 da.
Okay. Yeah.
They're like,
I've heard that, yes.
Okay. So all right. So it's like a goofy piece of silly parody magic, and that particular scatting that particular tune. Right?
Okay. Yeah.
You've seen that.
Yeah, I've seen it, I've heard it. Yeah.
Okay.
Done it.
I've heard it my whole life. And so a few months ago, I decided that it wasn't just my family thing. It wasn't just a New York thing. I wanted to know, why do magicians all over the country do that same thing? Where mm-hmm. did that come from? So as a sorceress, I have a big mailing list. I put out a call. I said, I am looking into this. What is this? And I had been told that tune, da 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 da, is actually, it's a song called Fine and Dandy.
Wow.
And it goes, everything is fine and dandy, sugar sweet when I'm with you. But I didn't know what the connection was with magic. So mm-hmm. I emailed, the entire membership of the SAM. And I cast a wide net. I don't know. Well, it turns out a bunch of people knew.
Oh, wow.
So there's this this comedian and actor, Art Matrano, who he was a comedian, and he was on all the late night shows, I want to say in the like early 70s kind of time.
Like Johnny Carson show and Merv Griffin.
Yeah, doing Carson and yeah, all that stuff. And that was the act that he did, was he would go da 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 da.
For people who are listening to the audio, by the way, you're putting your hands together. And when you put your hands together, like one finger goes to the other hand, we've got a finger up and two fingers cross.
Right. So one finger up on each hand, I'd bang them together, and then one would be a fist and there'd be two fingers on the other hand. It's all incredibly technical and astonishing.
Very astonishing. So that's where it comes from.
Sorry, I forgot that there's also an audio-only version. There are people going to be listening to this going, what the heck? So people started emailing me with information about this guy, Art Matrano, and sending me video of him doing this act, and it's hysterical. It's really funny. But I wanted more. I wanted to know more about this. So I started doing some research online, and I found him. And I found him living in Miami area, Florida.
Yeah.
With a business called Fine and Dandy, after Fine and Dandy Productions, after the song. And I called him, and he was kind enough to spend some time on the phone with me, telling me about the history of this act that he was doing and how he came up with the idea. And he was at a party, and a bunch of comedians were there, and everybody was asked to improvise a couple of minutes of something. Mm-hmm. And this is what came to him. And it went over so well, he decided to keep it, and it became kind of his thing.
Wow.
So, we had this great talk about it, and just a fascinating guy, and very kind to chat with me and tell me all this history. And I just found out last night that he passed away this week.
Oh my.
And so I'm a little sad. So as much as I love it, and it brings a big smile to my face, didn't know him well, just met him once, but he was so generous.
Well, there goes that opportunity. I was thinking this could make for a good podcast if I contact him, but
yeah, sorry.
Well, I'm glad that you have that story you could share with us.
But, absolutely.
And so that's what the resourceress does. That kind of comes full circle from what we've talked about from the beginning. You find out these things.
I'll tell you, he told me about, exactly. I mean, it was an interesting question. I ran it down, and so then I can share the story with the magic community. He told me about his first appearance, the first time he did Carson.
Mm-hmm.
And the stage manager told him, was very serious with him and instructed him that he is to go fast, do his bit, and get off stage.
Right.
Because the show was running long and he's got to get out of there because Johnny's got to wrap it up.
Right.
And so he gets out. He did not know at the time that Johnny Carson was a great lover
of
magic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that Carson just loved his piece and made him, after he did his little bit, made him come over and sit down and have a long talk. And that the stage manager was standing next to the camera going absolutely apoplectic.
Right. Yes.
But he's sitting there talking to Johnny. So.
What a story. Johnny.
Oh,
said, no, no, come on over. Sit down. This guy's going, no. You got to cut. We're running too long. Wow.
Right. It was, but what an opportunity for Mr. Matrano. So yeah, it was wonderful. And I could hear the pleasure in his voice remembering that, just telling me about that night on Johnny Carson.
Great story. Well, as we do close, the name of my podcast, as you know, is called The Magic Word. And so I always close by asking my guests what it is that is their philosophy of life. What is your phrase? What is it you live by? Not necessarily a word. It could be a series of words, whatever. What gives you inspiration and everything every day?
I have taken my, if I have a philosophy, then it's one that I took from the world of improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
And when you study improvisation, they say if somebody introduces an idea, you never say no, because that ends things. You have to add to it. And so when somebody introduces an idea, you say yes and. And that seems to be how I'm living my life.
I love that.
Yes and.
Well, then we won't close this other than saying thank you very much for being here. And I look forward to seeing you again sometime very soon.
I look forward to that too.
So with the magic
and
word.
We'll have dinner.
And a martini.
And a martini.
Absolutely. Thanks very much. It's been my pleasure. So for the Magic Word podcast, that was Sarah Crescent. This is Scotty out. Thank you, Sarah, for being my guest this week. A lot of great information was packed into this last hour and a few minutes, and I certainly got a lot out of it. And for more details on how you can own your magic and why you should, I recommend that you go to the website here at themagicwordpodcast.com, and there is a link where you can actually click on this, go directly to Amazon and purchase her book, and not only will it help her, but also because you are clicking through the magic word, you also get to help us a little bit. So we get a little love back from Amazon as well. And for that matter, if you are going to be purchasing anything on Amazon anytime as we get closer to the holiday season, be sure to go all the way to the bottom of any of the pages of themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you'll see a large logo that says Amazon Affiliate. Click on that. It will take you to your account there on Amazon. Because we're an affiliate, we just get a little bit back from Amazon. So thank you very much for remembering that and considering helping us out any way that you can. So that would be great. Also, as I mentioned this earlier in the beginning of this, we had recorded this conversation on Skype. So if you want to view that, you can go to youtube.com/Texas Magician, or just do a search for Scott Wells over on YouTube, and please subscribe to our channel. We're trying to get to 1,000. We're still just about 47 away, I guess, as of today, here on the 14th of October. So we could use your support. So please go and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And so I think this has been a pretty full episode and time to wrap up. And so until next week, stay well, get booked, and always have a positive attitude, and remember to say yes and. This is Scotty out.